Okay, everyone, welcome to session 314, the Once and Future Bee Priestess. My name is Chelsea Archibald. I'm the chair. And I just want to remind everyone to silence your cell phones. We don't want to mess up the recording or get the speaker distracted. I'm going to read some awesome bios. First, we have Elizabeth Russell Quick. She's an author and speaker with an MA in Women's Spirituality from the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, California. Her previous Sunstone sessions include ancient and contemporary female shamanism in Judeo-Christian and Mormon traditions, women's prophetic drumming tradition, and Emma Smith as a shaman. She blogs at bethanymagdalene.blogspot.com and priestessacademy.blogspot.com. Do Daughtry earned her PhD in religious studies at Arizona State University. Her specialty is religion in the Americas, with an emphasis on the new spirituality, religion, and popular culture, and the gendered experience of religion. She teaches courses on women and religion, religion in America, religion in popular culture, and Mormonism.
Does it sound like this microphone is working or is on?
No.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't. Okay.
Should just slide
testing. This doesn't sound like it's working.
Uh-oh. I might need that.
I think, did it come up flipped? Oh, no, it's not flipped.
It's wireless.
Okay. It was working earlier. Hello? Testing. Hello?
Sometimes the batteries go out.
Oh, dear.
Test. There you are. It's on now.
Thank you.
The laptop is working okay?
Oh, yeah. And that's going to be...
Yeah, that's recording right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Yes, and then we'll just edit out the garbage.
Okay.
The clapping.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Elizabeth Quick. This is the third installment in which I term a triptych, or a three-part series, which includes the first two papers that I have presented at Sunstone, Women's Prophetic Drumming Tradition and Emma Smith as Shaman. This third installment arose out of a term paper I did for my MA program titled The Mormon Bee Priestess. Since my original presentation of these papers, some significant new material, including astonishing archaeological discoveries, have come to my attention that have persuaded me that this material should be published together as a book, which I am tentatively titling The Once and Future Bee Priestess, Ancient and Contemporary Female Shamanism in Judeo-Christian and Mormon Traditions. I will soon be seeking a publisher, so if anyone is interested or has any referrals, please contact me. If I'm unable to find a satisfactory publishing arrangement, I will move forward and self-publish the book. So if anyone would like to be notified when the book becomes available, I will now pass around a clipboard where you can provide your contact information.
If anybody has a pen, let's start that, please.
In my first presentation, Women's Prophetic Drumming Tradition, a copy of which you can probably purchase from Sunstone on MP3 today if you'd like, I discussed the biblical evidence for the presence of a female shamanic tradition in ancient Israelite culture. So imagine my delight when just 3 months later, headlines announced around the world that the oldest shaman's grave had been discovered. And not only that, but that she was female. And not only that, but that she had been found in the land of Israel. They were calling her the Petite Priestess. Right off the bat, I was not surprised that she was female, since I asserted in my Emma Smith the Shaman paper, citing the research of many of the world's finest archaeologists and ethnologists, that all of the world's earliest shamans were indeed female. Calling her the oldest shaman is a bit of a misnomer, however, since anthropologist Barbara Tedlock states in one of her books that the oldest shaman's grave to be discovered was much older, that of another female shaman, who lived about 20,000 years ago in the Czech Republic. At just 5 feet tall and approximately 45 years old at the age of death, the tiny shaman is said to have come from the prehistoric Natufian culture, which existed between 13,000 and 10,000 years before present in the area of the Levant, which includes modern Israel, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. Among other artifacts, she was buried with over 50 complete tortoise shells in the body parts of a wild boar, an eagle, a cow, a leopard, two martens, and a complete human foot. And if you saw Margaret Toscano's slideshow a couple of days ago, what we are looking at right here is a real-life Lady of the Beasts. Scientists also discovered a spinal defect, which gave her a limp, perhaps a sacred limp, which I thought might be of interest to Brother Portlock, who's supposed to be here this morning. There is still debate about the origins of the Natufian culture, whether they were from North Africa or of Eurasian stock. They're of interest for a number of reasons, including the pioneering of agriculture, the domestication of the dog, and the world's oldest known depiction of lovemaking. There's probably a lot more research to be done to know for sure whether or not the Natufians were some of the ancestors of the biblical patriarchs, but my preliminary research suggests that it is very possible, if not probable. Either way, the synchronicity itself is compelling enough. let's see here, and... Okay, I'm going to move on. Pardon me. Coincidentally, around the same time, the sacred bee began swarming out of the woodwork from a multitude of directions. Or, I'm sorry, let me back up. I just skipped a paragraph. Pardon me. In Women's Prophetic Drumming Tradition, 2006, I made mention of the ancient bee priestesses of the Mediterranean world, which includes the biblical Deborah, whose name means bee, since their technologies for transforming consciousness included the use of the frame drum. Coincidentally, around that same time, the sacred bee began swarming out of the woodwork from a multitude of directions, re-emerging in contemporary consciousness. Although the phenomenon was recognized earlier, in late 2006, early 2007, much publicity was suddenly given to the mysterious vanishing of the bees, which began to be known as colony collapse disorder, due to the rate of attrition, which was alleged to have reached new proportions. That same year, a book, pardon me, The Shamanic Way of the Bee, Ancient Wisdom and Healing Practices of the Bee Masters by Simon Buxton, was released in January of 2006. In 2007, a germinal PhD dissertation by Marguerite Rigoglioso was published, titled Bearing the Holy Ones, The Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece, which gives an in-depth look at just one of many groups of bee priestesses in the ancient world. And in October of 2008, an American feature film was released based on a 2002 novel by Sue Monk Kidd titled The Secret Life of Bees, which contained a powerful depiction of the feminine divine. In December of 2008, I wrote a term paper for Vicki Noble's graduate course, The Priestess, Sacred Woman in Ancient Tribal and Contemporary Culture at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, which I titled The Mormon Bee Priestess. One of my sister scholars in the class, Barbara Fram, also wrote a paper on the bee priestess in ancient and modern times. And as part of her coursework, produced an evening in honor of the sacred honeybee, which included ancient songs and dances celebrating the bee from Bulgaria. In 2010, Lane Redmond, award-winning frame drummer and author of When the Drummers Were Women, which inspired my paper, Women's Prophetic Drumming Tradition, came out with a new album titled Hymns from the Hive, built on the actual drones of bees, framed by acoustic percussion, vocalizations, and other instruments inspired by sounds from the beehive. Just prior to all of this, in 2004, artist Nancy Macko released an experimental video titled Lore of the Bee Priestess, which she describes as a visual narrative of a lost history of ancient bee priestesses, an ancient, long-dead matriarchal culture evokes aspects of utopia, feminism, and spirituality, values that I believe, she says, are crucial to awaken and sustain in contemporary times. It is a piece created to evoke the spirit of a feminine odyssey, autonomy, and transformation, for which the bee priestess functions as the metaphor. The messages of transformation and regeneration are both visual and oral, incorporating original footage and sound from locations around the world. Marguerite Regoglioso's dissertation, Bearing the Holy Ones, the Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece, has since been published into a series of books, which are available at cultofdivinebirth.com. Although her thesis looks at the bee priestesses in the ancient Mediterranean world, she says that she has seen evidence of these types of ancient priestesshoods worldwide. She also came to a conclusion that a belief in virgin birth was not only at the foundation of Greek and Western religion, but it was at the very foundation of Western civilization itself. Her dissertation gives us a new and deeper understanding of the meaning of two important symbols, the dove and the bee, which were associated with Dodona and Delphi, the two major oracular sites in Greece. The bee was a symbol of both virgin birth and a matrifocal society. She says the queen is the only sexual being in the hive, and she reproduces two ways. One is a mid-air sexual encounter with several of the drones, and they impregnate her with the sperm, and that gives birth to the female worker bees. But the drones themselves, the males of the hive, whose only role is to impregnate the queen, after that they're sort of banished from the hive, the drones themselves are produced from the queen's body parthenogenetically. That is, she does not have sex with drones in order to fertilize for the drones. She just spews them out of her body spontaneously. So she's both sexual and asexual. She's a virgin mother, the bee, as well as being the matriarch of the hive. Regoglioso argues that like the bee, the dove was a symbol of parthenogenetic birth, and like the bee, the birds were also said to give prophecy. These symbols also immediately bring to my mind the Christian and Mormon traditions, respectively, and I see biblical parallels throughout Regoglioso's work. Throughout her work, her cross-cultural studies reveal that the more advanced spiritual practitioners of this planet have engaged in disciplines which result in seemingly extraordinary powers. She says that the Buddhist tradition calls those powers siddhis, which are obtainable at certain stages in the training of their consciousness. All we have to do in our own tradition is look no farther than Jesus Christ for the most obvious example of these types of abilities. Regoglioso says that whether you believe these things are possible or not, she finds it reasonable to assume that the final frontier for a magico-spiritual practitioner would have to be the ability to reproduce life from one's body in non-ordinary ways, calling it the ultimate accomplishment of mind over matter or spirit over matter to generate life within oneself through magical means. She cites the foundational myths of many religions, which are tales of non-ordinary methods of conception and birth, the most famous story being Mary's divine birthing of Jesus. She says that historically we have tended to focus on the product of the birth, the child, not the producer of the birth, the mother. In the patriarchal age, religious traditions have been dominated by male clergy, and writings have focused mainly on the spiritual accomplishments of male practitioners. In such a milieu, the fact that the experience of the mother is in miraculous birth situations figures outside of the male realm, renders it a topic unworthy of exploration. She questions whether these women were not passively submitting to the event, but actually proactive instigators. She asks, could the practice of attempting to achieve miraculous birth have been a bona fide siddhic aspiration? A few excerpts from a conference presentation she gave summarizes her findings. All of the legendary kings and rulers, and quite a few holy people, historical figures such as Plato, Pythagoras, and Alexander, all have virgin birth legends around them. So clearly this is something that has been ignored and obscured, that was first done on the part of the Greek writers themselves, which started to veil this tradition. And then, of course, we have scientism, which has entered into the picture, and secondary scholarship, which does not allow for this paradigm to come through. And so this is the beginning of the unveiling of this paradigm, which really, when we think about it, has been at the foundation of Christian religion and also Jewish religion, with the miraculous story of Sarah's birth of Isaac, Mary's birth of Jesus, Anne's birth of Mary, Elizabeth's birth of John the Baptist. It's really, really deeply ingrained in our tradition, and as I'll show you, it was deeply ingrained in the Greek tradition, the Egyptian tradition, and even the Roman tradition. Rigoglioso, quote, began to find a tremendous amount of material that there were virgin priestesshoods in ancient Greece that existed, whose purpose was to bring in high, holy level beings, avatars, to the planet, and that basically this was the highest form of shamanic practice possible, and that it was a road only open to women by virtue of their physiology. So we can begin to understand under patriarchy why this type of tradition would have been veiled, unquote. Or continuing the quote. Also important is the finding that achieving this feat on the part of the priestess was considered the highest level of magico-spiritual achievement possible, and what would happen is it would result in her own apotheosis, that is, her own divinization at the end of her life. If we think of Mary as a paradigm for this ambiguity as to her ontological status, was she human, was she divine, is the fact that she was a human woman who became divine as a result of achieving this feat. And so then she could operate on the astral, etheric realm as a deity, and she could be accessed that way. End quote. And I would add that this type of language and these types of ideas would probably have a familiar ring to members of the LDS Church. She continues, one of the methods that I use is taking myth seriously as repository for history, and that's the Neo-Euhemeristic tradition, pardon me if I'm mispronouncing that, but I try to cross-reference the myth with history as much as possible. She explains that there were, quote, stages of divine birth depending on the cultural stage, and she makes a case that the original cultural form of humanity was matriarchy, which was not women bashing men over the head, but rather as we have contemporary matriarchal societies today, these would be have been egalitarian, ecologically balanced societies of subsistence. So that was the original social form. Women were at the center and had high social value, economic value, and spiritual value. And under this form, what I discern, she says, is that the miraculous conception involved, pardon me, women in pure parthenogenesis, meaning conception without male sperm. How is this possible? Well, think about Tantra. This is a Tantra, she says, that is turned inward, and it requires virginity because it requires the inner congelation of the tantric energies of the woman, and it requires her to be in a deeply altered state of consciousness. It requires a high level of spiritual understanding. It requires the ability to work with light and matter and her own biological processes and DNA, and this is how it would have been possible. The conception under this practice would have been to conceive female avatars only. Again, this is under matriarchy, so we are creating lineages of queen priestesses who are representations of the great goddess. This is the first stage, which she calls the pure daughter-bearing parthenogenetic priestesshood. She believes that this is encoded in the Demeter Persephone story, and she believes that it is also encoded in these many, many, many so-called double goddess images that are all around the world. I think this is representing parthenogenetic reality, she says, women's magical shamanic practice. However, Rigoglioso doesn't believe this about doing... Okay. However, Rigoglioso doesn't believe anything about doing away with sexuality or heterosexuality. It's not about doing away with men, she says. This is simply about women utilizing their creative capacity to bring in beings who will advance humanity in some way. But of course, it can also be misused. In the secondary phase of pure parthenogenesis, where the women started bringing in male avatars, she terms this one the pure sun-bearing parthenogenetic priestesshood. It seems to be a stage where male gods are coming into ascendancy or attention, but it's still a parthenogenetic practice. There's no encounter of the female either with a male human or a male divine entity. And this is representing the mystery of the male's containment within the female. And this is a very primary understanding that Rigoglioso believes, quote, we must return to because that type of conception would allow us to write our gender relations again and put them back into a respectful order. Then she sees a rift, a change, where she grouped all of the stories of the so-called rapes of the women, the nymphs, and the virgins. She terms this later cultural stage Hieros Gamos, or sacred marriage with the god. What this represented was a period in which the women's shamanic trance state was being interrupted by the advent of the male god, an unwanted male god, into her tantric trance space when she was attempting virgin birth. This was a predatory activity. This was a reflection of deep astral events that were going on She says, I'm quoting Regoliozo here, because the myths actually tell us exactly what was happening. They're not fictional. They tell us about these astral dramas, and this was it. The male gods were forgetting that they were emanations of the feminine, and they were starting to come out of the power balance. And because they could not parthenogenetically reproduce themselves through their own bodies, because on the astral level they lacked womb space, they had to use the bodies of the females. And so we have the rapes of the goddesses as well as on Earth, as above, so below. We have the rapes of the priestesses. These start out as rape situations. We also see stories where the women actually shapeshifted to try to avoid the penetration by the male god. She believes that what these stories are talking about are shamanic suicides in a trance state on the part of these women who would rather die than give birth to these heroes, because these heroes were the issue of the gods. They were patriarchal. They were boring. They were Heracles. They were Theseus. They were Perseus. They were the men who actually came in through this means and then went about destroying the virgin birth priestesshoods. They went about destroying the matriarchy. The next stage she found in this activity was that eventually the women started giving in to the practice because they would still accrue benefits from this. But the human male would come in as a sexual actor with the priestess. And she says this represented a degeneration of the form. It was how the Egyptian civilization and the pharaohs came to be born, but it was a means of acquiring the practice into the male line now, because now you did have male sperm involved. There was a male actor, and even if the practice was not properly accomplished, there would generally be a pregnancy, and it could be said the child was divine. So then you can accrue all of the benefits and the lineage into the male line, whereas before it was exclusively the female. There was no male involved. So we have the encroachment of patriarchy. She concludes that the Greek understanding of conception was similar to the English word conception, which means to conceive in the mind as well as to conceive in the womb. And this is reflecting the understanding that the woman's body is porous. She can be both the oracle for the god's wisdom in the third eye, but that can also literalize by her being the receptacle for the god's child in her womb. This is why the oracles were both virgin birth priestesses and prophets, because these priestesshoods would be the ground where both of these things were going on. Marguerite also explains the long-standing relationship between bees and prophecy, particularly as an art carried out by women. She says that Homer's hymn to Apollo describes three prophetesses who lived in the heights above Delphi, and above them was an even older, oracular cave. And these three priestesses, who are called the Three-Eye, were described in this poem in bee-like terms. He describes them as swarming and flitting about, and they were said to have prophesied only after imbibing honey. And if they did not imbibe honey, they were not speaking the truth. But when they were imbibing honey, they were speaking the truth. And it's these very Three-Eye, these earlier, older priestesses, that apparently taught Apollo the art of prophecy when he was a child. So this is really referencing the oldest cult that women were associated with, Regoliozo says. They were associated not only with the bees, but with the product of the bees, which is the honey. Interestingly, a woman named Shirley Tannenbaum told Marguerite that she went on a tour at Delphi, and she was told by locals that at certain times of the year, they have to take some of the hives down because they are infused with a psychotropic element due to the bees collecting pollen from a certain type of flower. In light of all of this information, imagine my surprise the following year, summer of 2008, when I was sitting in my sister's home. My brother-in-law-to-be is an archaeologist, and I was flipping through his then-current copy of Biblical Archaeology Review, July-August 2008, where a major, major archaeological discovery was reported. Now, Israel has always been known as the land of milk and honey, but no one had ever discovered any actual evidence of beekeeping in ancient Israel until now. If this had only been a discovery shedding further light on the history of ancient agriculture, that's huge in and of itself, especially to the Mormons I later saw publishing in their blogs that this was further evidence for the truth of the Book of Mormon as well. But what was discovered went far beyond agriculture, as there turned out to be an overt religious connotation in their honey-producing practices. When I stumbled across the images in this article, I just about fell off my chair. The article is titled, "To What God? Altars and a House Shrine from Tel Rehov Puzzle Archaeologists." Tel Rehov is a 25-acre mound in Israel, halfway between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee in the Jordan Valley. The archaeological term mound is also known in Hebrew as a tel, hence the name Tel Rehov, and is created by human occupation and abandonment of a geographical site over many centuries. A classic tel looks like a low, truncated cone with a flat top and sloping sides. The article says that although Rehov is not mentioned in the Bible, it is mentioned in the Egyptian records and must have been an important city in the biblical period. Excavations have revealed a number of well-planned and densely built cities dating from 1000 to 900 BCE, or 3000 years before present. The middle of these three superimposed strata, maybe the one mentioned in the Egyptian Shishank inscription, and was destroyed violently by fire, possibly by the military campaign of the king of Egypt, Shishank I, a.k.a. Shishak in the Hebrew Bible. The rebuilt city was again violently destroyed, possibly due to the wars between Israel and the Aramaean kingdom of Damascus, ruled by Hazael, who invaded Israel between 840 and 830 BCE, which is described in the biblical book of 2 Kings. Bad news for them, but the good news for us is that all of this destruction has yielded a treasure trove of restorable pottery vessels, seals and sealings, clay figurines, and some unique cultic objects. Among the treasures of interest is this picture that I have on the PowerPoint here, a complete, almost fully restorable altar, about 1.5 feet tall, and resembles a city gate, the significance of which eludes researchers. There are rounded horns on each of the four corners. Each horn is incised with palm tree branches. Traces of burning on the top indicate it was probably used for burnt offerings, although we have only speculation and many theories as to what was burned, from incense to animal meat. But most significantly, between the window-like openings in the altar's tower is an incised schematic palm tree. On either side of the two lower windows, a mold-made figure of a nude female goddess was applied. The article states, the complete altar was found together with a beautiful painted chalice and other bowls and vessels about 15 feet from an area devoted to producing honey and beeswax. This apparently was what we might call a cultic corner related to this industry. In this area, we uncovered rows of unbaked clay cylinders shaped just like the traditional beehives that are well known in villages throughout the eastern Mediterranean basin, as well as from pictorial descriptions from ancient Egypt. This identification has been analyzed and proven. They found molecular traces of beeswax embedded in the clay, and as far as they know, these are the only beehives ever discovered in an archaeological excavation in the entire ancient Near East. They add, the proximity between the altar and the apiary confirms what we know from other sites. Religious rituals were often performed in direct relation to the production of a certain item, such as copper or olive oil. A second altar of much higher quality was also discovered, depicting nude female goddesses as well as fragments of other altars. Only 1% of the site has been excavated at the time of publication, but they estimate there are probably hundreds more of the same kind. Archaeologists assert these altars must have played an important role in the daily routine of Rehov's inhabitants. A third altar was discovered, located in an open-air sanctuary serving a neighborhood or group of families. In the same building, where the second altar was found, was the discovery of a house shrine 15 by 11 inches. Above its facade, with an open doorway, is a rope-like applique, possibly depicting a snake. A lion, identified by its dangling tongue, sprawls atop, its paws positioned on two human heads. The authors ask, who are these figures? Does this scene reference some unknown ritual? Are these figures characters from a lost local mythology? The depiction is unparalleled and baffling, but they speculate, judging from the discovery of other household-type shrines, that it may have held fertility figurines or other sacred objects or cultic paraphernalia. The building where these discoveries were made is also considered unique, but its function remains a mystery. Adjoining the western side of the main room were four small consecutive rooms, each of which was lined with benches. In the innermost room was a large, heavy clay crate that may have been used to store valuables. It was found with its lid upside down next to it, as if it had been emptied hastily before the fiery destruction of the building. A storage jar was found inside, bearing an inscription with the name Nimshi, which just happens to have been the name of the father or grandfather of biblical King Jehu, known from the first and second book of Kings. To conclude, the archaeologist's tentative interpretation of these finds contains far more questions than answers. Quote, "The most difficult question for us to answer is, who produced the altars at the house shrine found at Tel Rehov? From a geographical perspective, Tel Rehov was clearly in the northern kingdom of Israel during the late 10th and early 9th centuries BCE. We have traced the artistic and cultic functions of these objects, however, further back to the second millennium BC, 1,000 years earlier, in Israel and Syria, before the emergence of the Israelites. It can be assumed that although Rehov was part of the United Monarchy and the Northern Kingdom of Israel, much of its population remained Canaanite and retained traditions, particularly of Northern origin, that were hundreds of years old. This affinity is expressed in other aspects of the material culture of Rehov in the 10th through 9th centuries BCE, such as the architectural plan of the buildings, for example, the lack of pillared four- and three-room types so common in Israelite architecture, and the building techniques, brick construction without stone foundations, which are not found in other Israelite architecture. The continuity of Canaanite population in the Beth Shean and Jezreel valleys is often noted in the Bible. For example, the book of Judges tells us, but Manasseh did not drive out the people of Beth Shean or Taanach, or Dor, or Ibleam, or Megiddo. I'm sorry, I did not have time to research how to pronounce these words. And their surrounding settlements. For the Canaanites were determined to live in that land. When Israel became strong, they pressed the Canaanites into forced labor, but never drove them out completely. It may be that this Canaanite population retained its traditional religious practices, worshiping deities like Baal and Asherah. No doubt, at the time of the Israelite monarchy, the worship of Yahweh was slowly adopted by this local population. The struggle between the emerging Israelite religion and the worship of Canaanite deities is a prominent theme in the biblical narrative. For example, in the contest between Elijah and the priests of Baal on Mount Carmel, 1 Kings 19. The altars and house shrine from Tel Rehov were probably used in the local private cult practice in homes and workshops. Offerings were made for both personal well-being and industrial success. Such private religious practices serving individual families or local communities stood apart from the royal official religious centers like the Temple in Jerusalem or the royal shrine in the northern kingdom of Israel at Dan. Popular religion in Israel is well known from the various archaeological finds, such as the many fertility figurines found in both Israel and Judah, but the popularity of pottery, horned altars, and the unique depiction on the house shrine from Tel Rehov are unparalleled elsewhere. So who knows? Who knows? But very interesting and compelling and synchronistic. Moving on. In his brilliant essay on the sacred bee, independent Mormon scholar Carrie Schertz asks this question. Why has the bee been brought back into our consciousness in the restored gospel of Jesus Christ? Well, repeated echoes from the remote past keep reminding us that the office and calling of the bee was to bring about the stirrings of life, reviving the biological cycle in a world that has been totally ravaged by the cosmic forces of destruction. Is then Deseret waiting in the wings, held in reserve against the day soon to come when its salutary services will once again required? Interestingly, archaeologist Maria Gimbutas states that the bee was a symbol of regeneration and an epiphany of the ancient Great Mother Goddess, which was worshipped, according to her research and the research of others, worldwide in Neolithic and Paleolithic times around the world. Other bee symbolism includes the precession of the equinoxes and the transition between an old world and a new world, as well as a symbol of resurrection and a millennial forerunner. In my December 2008 term paper for Vicki Noble's Priestess class, I wrote, The Mormon tradition as a vehicle or religious system emerged in the early to mid-1800s, but it claims to be part of a larger tradition or stream that is primordial. The tradition itself claims internally to be non-sectarian, but in accordance with human nature, many sects have emerged over the last century and a half, claiming the correct interpretation. The largest, most well-known sect is the Utah-based Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, LDS, of which I am a seventh-generation member. But at this time, I consider myself a non-sectarian Mormon mystic. In lieu of a comprehensive examination, it may be important to note a few things here. Cosmologically, spirit and matter are considered essentially the same substance, one being finer or vibrating at a different rate than the other, as on a spectrum. Matter and form are considered to be what allows spirit and consciousness to express itself and have joy, and are seen in nothing but positive terms. A human soul is defined not as spirit, but the spirit and the body joined together into a soul. Spirit is believed to infuse all things. Everything is considered to have a divine nature. In Mormon scripture, the earth is called our mother. She speaks to humans and vice versa, is fully conscious and sentient. Animals are also living souls, and many Mormons expect to be reunited with beloved pets at future times in their spiritual journey. Another belief is human apotheosis and the existence of divine celestial ancestors, including a divine mother and father in heaven. Existence is cyclical and includes the idea of eternal progression, perhaps what we in contemporary times might call spiritual evolution. The Mormon tradition is neither Catholic nor Protestant. It is more closely related to the underground stream of Western esotericism. The Mormon tradition rejects the cross as an icon. The tradition also rejects the notion of original sin. Mainstream religious critics of the tradition frequently accuse it of being pantheistic, animistic, and pagan. The tradition posits that there was once a primordial golden age, which was a sacred culture. Paradise was lost, history happened as we know it, but a new golden age approaches. Mormons believe their tradition to be not so much a religion, but a great work, the work of restoration of a once and future sacred society they call Zion. Mormons do not believe that they are the only ones engaged in this work, but that it is a divinely orchestrated worldwide phenomenon. The restorative work of this women's spirituality program at ITP fits very easily within the Mormon paradigm, and from a Mormon perspective, scholars such as Maria Gimbutas could be seen as a prophetess or seer. The book Women in Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism, examines the origins of the concept of the divine feminine and the origins of the priestess in early Mormonism. The anthology edited by Maxine Hanks traces the emergence and decline of the priestess in the Mormon tradition with essays such as The Mormon Concept of a Mother in Heaven, The Historical Relationship of Mormon Women and Priesthood, Mormon Women as Natural Seers and Enduring Legacy, Mormon Women Have Had the Priesthood Since 1843, and Women as Healers in the Modern Church. Further documentation can be found in Carolyn Pearson's Daughters of Light, a collection of historical accounts of 19th century Mormon women acting as priestess, healing the sick, and performing miracles. Claire Nowall's book, Guardians of the Hearth, Utah's Pioneer Midwives and Women Doctors, is another crucial source, providing accounts of a former practice of setting apart or consecrating with a prayer or blessing female midwives and doctors in Utah as a priesthood office. Some of the earliest trained and educated female doctors in America were from Utah. In Strangers in Paradox, Explorations in Mormon Theology, Margaret and Paul Toscano trace the evidence of priesthood for women and the existence of a female divinity in Mormon and Judeo-Christian traditions. The work of Gimbutas, which unfortunately I was going to read a little bit about the life and work of Gimbutas, which I feel is really congruent with Mormon tradition, but anyway... The work of Gimbutas also resonates strongly with Mormon ideas. Mormon scripture predicts that a stream of sacred records will begin to pour forth from the ground in the latter days, so many Mormons enthusiastically expect the types of discoveries made by archaeologists like Maria Gimbutas. One point of resonance that I've located in The Living Goddess is Gimbutas, which is a book by Maria Gimbutas, is Gimbutas' analysis of the sacred nature of the primordial temple-centered society. Gimbutas states, our Neolithic ancestors intimately wove their secular and sacred lives together without ideological segregation. Art, craft, and religion were one, She says that the contemporary mind finds the Neolithic temple-centered society incomprehensible because our daily activities normally are separate from our spiritual lives. The Mormon tradition, however, is not a once-a-week religion, but a prophetic movement engaged in the ushering in of the future Zion, a sacred temple-centered society that creates heaven on earth, or the Hermetic maxim, as above, so below. Gimbutas found that old European temples integrated women's daily activities, particularly bread baking, cloth weaving, and pottery making, into sacred practice. Spinning and weaving constituted other activities carried on by women in temples. She says, abstruse, arcane rituals did not take place here. The temple sanctified everyday activities. In fact, the location of the temple among dwellings further strengthens the connection between the temple and everyday life. In old Europe and throughout much of prehistory, people did not separate the sacred from the mundane. The sacred force imbued every activity. Unfortunately, Gimbutas says, drastic cultural transformation eventually caused the devaluation of women's work and its removal from the spiritual sphere. She concludes that the temple evidence confirms the strong position of these groups of Neolithic women. Perhaps we can even say that the temple belonged to the realm of women who both supervised and participated in its rituals. A comparison of Gimbutas' findings with Mormon history is of interest. The temple, and where there is not a temple, a tabernacle, is the literal geographical center of the hundreds of villages that Mormons established in the western United States in the 19th century. Mormon scholar Hugh Nibley states, Latter-day Saints believe that their temple ordinances are as old as the human race and represent a primordial revealed religion that has passed through alternate phases of apostasy and restoration, which have left the world littered with the scattered fragments of the original structure, some more and some less recognizable, but all badly damaged and out of proper context. Keeping in mind that Mormons believe the restoration has only just begun and that we are far from the completed worldwide sacred culture, these early Mormon writings are fascinating to juxtapose with Gimbutas. In his book, The Women of Mormondom, 19th century Mormon writer Edward Tollage hailed Mormon women as apostolic mediums of a new revelation, who upon coming into contact with the Mormon tradition were not as sinners converted to Christianity, but as disciples who had been waiting for the fullness of the everlasting gospel. He prophesied the coming age of woman, predicting a new age of women's spirituality and the future apostolic mission of women that would transform the planet. His discussion of the temple as the place of woman brings to my mind Gimbutas' comments. The divine romance of the sisterhood best opens at Kirtland, Ohio. It is the place where this Israelitish drama of our times commenced its first distinguishing scenes, the place where the first Mormon temple was built. Thus, Kirtland became an adopted Zion, selected by revelation as a gathering place for the saints, and a little village grew into a city with a temple. There is a rare consistency in the mysticism of the Mormon Church. The daughters of the temple are so by right of blood and inheritance. They are discovered by the gift of revelation in Him, with a capital H, who is the voice of the Church. But they inherit from their fathers and mothers of the temple of the Old Jerusalem. How stands woman in the grand temple economy as she loomed up her mission from the house of the Lord in Kirtland? The apostles and elders laid the foundations, raised the arches, and put on the capstone, but it was the woman that did the inner work of the temple. George A. Smith hauled the first load of rock. Heber C. Kimball worked as an operative mason, and Brigham Young as a painter and glazier in the house. But the sisters wrought on the veils of the temple. Sister Polly Angel, wife of Truman O. Angel, the church architect, relates that she and a band of sisters were working on the veils one day when the prophet Joseph Smith and Signe Rigdon came in. "Well, sisters," observed Joseph, "you are always on hand. The sisters are always first and foremost in all good works. Mary was the first at the resurrection, and the sisters are now the first to work on the inside of the temple." 'Tis but a simple incident, but full of significance. It showed Joseph's instinctive appreciation of woman and her mission. Her place was inside the temple, and he was about to put her there, a high priestess of Jehovah, to whose name he was building temples. and wonderfully suggestive was his prompting that woman was the first witness of the resurrection. Once again, woman had become an oracle of a new dispensation and a new civilization. She can only properly be this when a temple economy comes round in the unfolding of the ages. She can only be a legitimate oracle in the temple. When she dares to play the oracle without her divine mission and anointing, she is accounted in society as a witch, a fortune teller, a medium who divines for hire and sells the gifts of the invisibles for money. But in the temple, woman is a sacred and sublime oracle. She is a prophetess and a high priestess. Inside the temple, she cannot but be as near the invisibles as man nearer indeed. From her finer nature, inside the mystic veil, the emblems of which she has worked upon with her own hands. In the temples, both of the heavens and the earth, woman is found. She is there in her character of Eve and in her character of Zion. The one is the type of the earth, the other the type of heaven. The one the mystical name of the mortal, the other of the celestial woman. The Mormon prophet rectified the divine drama. Man is nowhere where woman is not. Mormonism has restored woman to her pinnacle. Presently, woman herself shall sing of her divine origin. A high priestess of the faith shall interpret the themes of herself and of her father and mother God. In the book, The Double Goddess, Women Sharing Power, I have discovered a number of auspicious synchronicities between the early Mormon priestess and the ancient bee priestess. J. Michael Hunter says, "The bee and beehive symbols had deep religious significance for Mormons of the 19th century. The bee and beehive represented the sum total of all the LDS Church was trying to achieve, the building of the kingdom of God on the earth. In representing God's kingdom, the bee and beehive symbols encompassed all aspects of Mormon life and culture. The bee and beehive symbols, in effect, encompassed all other symbols used by the Mormons. The symbol's religious significance is evidenced by their common use in the most sacred of Mormon buildings and the temples. They were also commonly used in chapels, on caskets, and on tombstones. In the 19th century, Mormons also placed beehives on quilts, furniture, sculptures, paintings, architectural designs, poetry, music, and sermons. After Utah became a state, the beehive was incorporated into the state seal, and to this day, Utah is known as the Beehive State. The symbols are still so ubiquitous in Utah that they appear on sidewalks, highway signs, ambulances, government patches, badges, and police cars, hundreds of business signs and logos, and folk art. In 1980, Hal Cannon created a photographic exhibit featuring all of these past and present hives. The exhibit was so successful that it was brought to the Smithsonian in 1981. Like the bee priestess of old, Mormon women, some well into the late 19th century in communities like Orderville, Utah, lived in communitarian settings with collective ownership of property and cooperative-style businesses. Until the 1970s, the Relief Society was the autonomous organization of Mormon priestesses when it was finally fully absorbed into the LDS Corporation. Into the 20th century, the Relief Society independently operated a communal grain storage program in close physical proximity to the temple, reminiscent of the ancient bee priestesses. Jesse L. Embry says that the Relief Society's attempts to direct economic affairs was unique for women in the 19th century. The grain storage program was also important because of what it reveals about the independent role that women and the church's organization of women played in Mormon church government. One interesting aspect of the program, according to historian Leonard J. Arrington, is the manner in which it assisted the women to achieve an independent position in Mormon government. Non-Mormon history professor Peggy Pasco says in her review of Women of Covenant, The Story of Relief Society, that the list of Relief Society innovations is long and impressive, but the society created a grain storage program that, to me, she says, seems so innovative as to be almost unique in women's organizational annals. Historically, Historically, some examples of women serving in a capacity similar to a mission administrator come to mind. Emmeline B. Wells was called by Brigham Young in 1876 to preside over the church's grain-saving effort, commonly termed a mission. Wells, though overwhelmed by the size of the grain storage project, saw herself a modern Joseph in Egypt and asked for the support of the Relief Society's. Previous Relief Society president, Eliza R. Snow, appointed Wells chair of the Central Grain Committee. This program or mission developed into an extensive real estate and commercial enterprise church-wide. Bishops later became involved on the board level. Emmeline, who presided from 1876 to 1918, could be considered the church's first female mission president. I just realized I was quoting Maxine Hanks, sorry. Emmeline B. Wells, at least that last quote, Emmeline B. Wells, the president of the Relief Society and Utah's vice president of the National Women's Suffrage Association, who built coalitions with the best-known feminists of her day, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, said herself, "The work that has been done in the saving of grain is unusual and unique for women. Joseph in Egypt was the only one that saved and stored wheat for a great nation. Great indeed." In 1907, the church's general membership voted to send 20 tons of flour from the grain storage program to China for famine relief. Additional parallels between the Mormon and ancient bee priestesses of old include a sacred relationship with gold, its ideal use being viewed as a sacred technology for spiritual purposes and not for materialistic gain, the divinatory practice of scrying, and the use of entheogens, the sacred use of plants, to induce mystical states of awareness. Sadly, throughout the 20th century, the role of the Mormon priestess diminished until the only remaining place in the contemporary LDS church where the priestessing of women is still sanctioned is in the LDS temples. How did this happen? Margaret Toscano explains, 19th century Mormonism was radical in many ways and challenged the status quo of American culture at large, including the position and role of women. Joseph Smith's theology introduced a concept of a mother god, acknowledged the power and equality of women, and gave them priesthood through the temple ritual. According to a number of scholars, although Mormon women in early Utah were the second group in the USA to receive the vote in 1870, which was only 2 months after Wyoming granted women this right, Utah women were actually the first to use their franchise and vote in an election. Mormon women had other rights during the 19th century unknown to most women in the rest of the country. Married women had the same legal rights as single women, including the rights to own property in their names, represent themselves in court, and win easy access to divorce. In the 19th century, Mormon women were avid suffragettes who argued and fought for the rights of all women. They were in contact with Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and others in the National Women's Movement. Through the LDS Women's Organization, the Relief Society, Mormon women controlled their own money and buildings, organized a hospital and other charitable organizations, which, among other things, collected, stored, and distributed grain and other food supplies, supported home industries such as silk farms, and ran a women's newspaper, the Women's Exponent, 1872 to 1914, which advocated female independence, education, and careers, and emphasized female leadership and spiritual gifts. In the early 20th century, Mormonism went through a redefinition. Toscano is continuing. She says, in the early 20th century, Mormonism went through a redefinition in order to fit into mainstream American culture and rid itself of its polygamous and politically autonomous past, which had been seen as, by many as anti-American. In a conservative reaction to its own history, Mormonism attempted to shuck off those elements of its theology and practice which made it unacceptable to the larger culture while still retaining enough of its uniqueness to set it apart as a religion with a divine and separate calling from the rest of Christianity in America. Among other things lost during this period were the concepts of women's spiritual gifts and their role as priestesses, a term used to define such women as Eliza R. Snow in the 19th century. Although women retained control of their own Relief Society organization until the early 1970s, they gradually lost the management of their own affairs and publications from the time of statehood in 1896 onward, along with their sense of independence. Ironically, the image of Mormon women as docile homemakers, a la June Cleaver, serving Jell-O to a smiling family in a 1950s sitcom, is just one of the many things Mormonism adopted from a conservative American culture. Influenced by the national feminist movement of the 1970s, Mormon women began to reclaim their history and to participate in women's groups as part of an attempt to redefine women's roles and opportunities in the LDS context. This is not to say that Mormon women did not participate in feminism during the first half of the 20th century. End quote. Currently, Toscano says, quote, "Mormon doctrines of female priesthood and female divinity are not seen as essential or fully legitimate, nor have their implications been sufficiently explored or ramified. Though these concepts are rooted in Mormonism, they have remained as dormant seeds planted in the early days of the church. It appears to be the work of women and men in our day to water those seeds, to let them sprout, grow, blossom, and bring forth fruit." End quote. But I would add, in conclusion, that the Mormons are told in their own scriptures that the work of the restoration will roll forth with or without them.
Well, I have about 5 minutes, so I
will try
to rush through this. I'll talk fast. I'm focusing mainly on the bees. I've been long been interested in bees and honey. When our children were small and we lived in a small Texas town with no homeowners associations, my husband brought home several beehives from his grandmother's New Mexico pecan orchard and set them up in the backyard. And I was a sheltered city girl, and as always, the things he was familiar with and the extent of his knowledge of earth-based processes impressed and humbled me. When Grace Pundick's book, The Honey Trail, In Pursuit of Liquid Gold and Vanishing Bees, was published in 2010, I bought it and we began reading it aloud to each other as we traveled, which is a habit that we developed earlier in our marriage. And I've long yearned to keep bees again. I bought several books and cultivated relationships in my local permaculture association with that goal. And then I found that my 3/4-acre lot was 1/4 acre too small for legal beekeeping, and then there was, of course, the even more threatening entity of my HOA. My preparation for this particular response to Elizabeth really started about a month ago when I sat down with a friend to watch a documentary about bees titled Queen of the Sun, What Are the Bees Telling Us?, directed by Taggart Siegel. According to Michael Pollan, who appears in the film, without the honeybee, we would not have any number of foodstuffs available for us. 40% comes from honeybees pollinating plants. He says, 4 out of 10 bites we consume, we would not consume were it not for the work of the honeybee. Ian Davies, another contributor to the film, summarizes, they are keeping us alive, not the other way around. But bees are in crisis for a variety of reasons, including the evolution of honey gathering and beekeeping from local to global industries. Not only is honey being diluted and or simply substituted with other sweet substances, but corn syrup is actually poured into hives to supplement what bees are not getting from scarce pollen, complete with antibiotics that we then eat as an inherent ingredient of the honey. This situation has developed largely because commercially kept bees are transported from field to field from one monoculture crop, such as almonds, to another, like slaves. Gunther Hawk, one of the many beekeeping experts, expert beekeeping contributors to the film, says, they are giving us messages. Their crisis is our crisis. Colony collapse disorder of the human being, too. A hive is found empty. Food is there. Honey is there. But the bees are gone. Hauk is grateful for the crisis because he says it will open our minds and tell our hearts something. As Elizabeth has shown, the honeybee is sacred. Like the goddess, our heavenly mother, the bee embodies not only nurturing and fertility, but oh, so much more. All of the major world civilizations recognize the bee as a sacred being. It has obvious cultural capital in Mormonism. As Mary Brown Maloof observes in her Salt Lake Magazine article from 2001, they're everywhere on the state highway signs, on the Capitol building, on the state flag, on manhole covers. Dozens of Salt Lake businesses begin their name with Beehive. Beehive Bail Bonds, Beehive Tea Room, Beehive Auto, Beehive Elementary School, so on and so forth. I've observed that beehives and bees appear on doorknobs, temples, Brigham Young's home. It is the diminutive of and the official insect of the state itself, the land of Deseret, its flag and emblem. It appears as a young women's retreat theme and the name of the church's publishing entity extracted from the Book of Mormon's language of the Jaredites. As one bee enthusiast in the UK states, to Mormons, the beehive is a symbol of the kingdom of God, a harmonious society ruled by the Creator. However, for Mormons, this harmonious society is mostly often articulated as industry, or what I would call the busy bee syndrome. Despite what outsiders might consider to be our obsession with the honeybee, it appears to me that except for our romantic Deseret Book kitsch, the true message of the true sacred message of the bee is lost on modern Mormons. We have relegated our only relationship to the honeybee and its hive to this concern with busyness, or business, as has been the subject of a recent controversial Business Week article. Even our concept of the afterlife has long been described not as an environment of discovery, rest, and rejuvenation, or even, you know, like progression, but as an eternity of being busy, industriously busy, for working for the church. This loss reminds me of another missing in the institutional church, specifically that of Heavenly Mother. Therefore, I want to compare the crisis of the health bees to the crisis of the church with regard to its relationship to the goddess. We might compare the mechanistic control of nature I described earlier to the correlation program, which Elizabeth described. Pointing to the eternal potential and status of LDS women, Heavenly Mother is an invisible and mute icon of this institutional relationship and crisis. If monoculture is the original sin of agriculture, a Heavenly Mother who has been minimized to the point of erasure from institutional discourse by manufacturing fairy tales of her sacrality or her incorporation and thereby disappearance into the category Heavenly Parents can be seen as the sin of Mormon monotheism. Driving through Salt Lake, one might think that the honeybee and its products are sacred to Mormons. However, as Maloof admits, visitors ask, "Where are the bees?" She says she is surprised how few native and resident Utahns know the reason Utah is called the Beehive State. It has nothing to do, she says, with insects. The state ranks 24th in the U.S. honeybee production. In other words, like the institutional attitude about Heavenly Mother, bees support a particular world view of the world that erases their real meaning and purpose, keeping us alive. Despite the fact that the institutional church stubbornly clings to gender binaries that render Heavenly Mother obscure and superfluous for the salvation of human being, as against knowledge about Heavenly Father being vital, there has nevertheless been a resurgence of individual and group discourse about and activity in relation to Heavenly Mother among LDS women and men. They are engaging her in new ways, including various ways of communicating and developing relationship with her. However, I have also witnessed online arguments from other Mormons who increasingly insist that because the church has never articulated a true doctrine of a Heavenly Mother, we don't actually believe in one. It is true that like Heavenly Father and other gods, she exists not on her own but in relationship with human beings. Regardless of their position on the issue, LDS women and men know that instinctively. We are in a symbiotic relationship with the bees and the goddess, both of whom can be called the Queen of the Sun. Without text, images, ritual, and the other activities that give them life, gods die. Without Heavenly Mother and without the bees, we die. The operative question, then, posed by the film about bees should also be on our lips with regard to Heavenly Mother. Do we really want to eat only bread and oatmeal?